This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
بسم الله والحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله الحمد لله حمدا يوافي نعمه ويكافئ مزيده صلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. اللهم علمنا ما ينفعنا وانفعنا بما علمتنا وزدنا علما يا كريم. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. رب زدني علما رب زدني علما رب زدني علما. I want to start with like, what exactly does Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif mean to me? And why am I talking about him? Firstly, I think that across North America and maybe a lot of the world, a lot of the khutab today would have been about Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif. If you go online, go on YouTube, just type in a tribute to Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif, you'll find dozens of lectures given on this topic today. And probably a few more will come out over the next few weeks as well. So for me personally, I grew up in the 90s and 2000s in Toronto. Before that in 80s and of course my early childhood is in Saudi Arabia. So in that time, there really were not many options. And I think a lot of you are around that same age, right? So there really were not too many options to learn Islam, right? My parents were very keen on me going to any halaqa possible. And I will be honest, even though I'd memorized, you know, a lot of the Quran when I was younger, and my parents tried to instill as much ilm and values within them, I would never feel connected to the masjid. 100%. The only time I would feel connected with the masjid was when we would go and do sleepovers. That's it. Right? Because the person that would be speaking to us in the masjid, he didn't know how to speak English. And this was the reality that a lot of us growing up in Canada, in Toronto, and maybe even over here even more so, had to experience, because all of the imams were imported. And this is not to say those were bad people. They were great human beings. But at that time, we didn't have a system of our very own going overseas, studying and coming back and teaching, right? So the language, there was a clear language barrier. My Urdu is not all that. So the only main language I had at that time was my English. So I would go to the masjid and I could barely communicate with the imam. And so naturally, I would feel a disconnect. And then around early 2000s, one of our family friends from somewhere in the States, I don't know, my mom's childhood friend, she started to send cassettes to our house that were of this gentleman. And we didn't quite know who he was, obviously, because nobody really knew him at that time. And these cassettes were speaking to me because they were lectures that would be in English. They would talk about and address topics that would be very relevant to me as a teenager at that time. And I would feel very connected. So we would listen to this, me, my brother, my sister, all of the siblings. Everybody would be listening to these cassettes, and that was actually Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif. We didn't know because he wasn't quite famous at that time. And so when he moved over to Toronto, to Ottawa, his parents were in Toronto, but he wouldn't moved over to Ottawa. At that time, he slowly started to come back and forth. And around this time, more and more of the native English-speaking graduates, they started to come around as well. And the odd treat would have when Dr. Bilal Phillips would come over and he would do his lectures and these type of things. So those were treats that I cannot forget, because I'm finally speaking to a person who actually understands my language, right? I'm able to communicate. And this is a very key, important point. And wallahi, you as community members, you also need to fill this in to all of the masajid. Alhamdulillah, in our masjid, we have imams, all of whom speak English properly. They grew up in Canada, etc. But still, till now, in Edmonton, in other places, we have imams who cannot speak English. Yeah, sure, they can lead the salah. But if you have a khutbah being given by a man who cannot speak English, how is he going to relate to people? How is he going to talk to people? How is anyone going to feel safe communicating with them, right? And there's a lot of people who have went overseas and come back in studies, and you should push this agenda of we need to have people who are able to speak the language of the people. This is one of the keys with which Allah sends the risala. وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا مِنْ رَسُولٍ إِلَّا بِلِسَانِ قَوْمِهِ لِيُبَيِّنَ لَهُمْ. We never sent a messenger except with the tongue of the people, so they may be able to understand, right? So we finally began to understand. There's like opportunity now. You can hear lectures from people. One of the pioneers at this time really was Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif. He faded out over the recent years, and that's why a lot of people who came into the deen more recently, they don't really know Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif, because he kind of retired about 10 years ago, or less than that, from the da'wah scene, as we call it. He kind of retired for reasons I'll talk about in a bit. Okay, so he started this institute, which he started in the States, and he started bringing it to Toronto, and this was called the Al-Maghrib Institute. And I took maybe 4 or 5 classes with them before I had headed off to my studies. And a couple of those courses were with Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif. And this was formative for me, because again, I'm seeing a person who went over to, like, there's an example before me, someone who went over, he learned Islam, and he speaks my language, he's got the Quran memorized, he had very melodious tone and recitation as well, mashallah. And these were like, the typical idea of who an imam is, like, you know, when you start to have like a cognitive dissonance, like you're like, what's going on? Like, this is how an imam should be. He's able to speak English and he's able to communicate ideas, and he's even ahead of you, in 3 steps ahead of you in every other way, even when it comes to personal development and self-help, and he's taking courses with Tony Robbins, and like, who is this guy, right? Like, this is the type of feeling that came over me, because in the middle of our class, he would come and tell us, get up, start doing jumping jacks. Never been in a halaqa where you're being told to do jumping jacks, right? Right? It was an interesting thing. Now, I don't necessarily do my halaqat like that, but still, I remember experiencing that. I'm like, this is interesting. Okay, part of the halaqa. Do jumping jacks, right? But like, obviously, he's trying to get the blood flowing, and he's thinking of it from these angles, and he's trying to get all of the people with, after an hour, they lose focus. He's trying to get people to refocus. So these things were really captivating, right? And so this is why I'm talking about him. So he had something to do with my early development in ilm. Of course, after that, I went overseas for about 15 years, right? That was a different experience. But here, this was the very early stages I got to learn from him, and there was really some things I always remembered, right? So who is Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif? Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif, he memorized the Qur'an. He was born in 1975, 1395 in Hijrah. He memorized the Qur'an as a young man. And he graduated from the Islamic University of Medina with a degree in Sharia or law, and that was the class of 1999. So you can do the math on that, right? And from what I saw and what everybody knows about him, was he was an extremely focused human being. He was a very jolly human being, very fun to be around, but he knew exactly what he wanted. And he was going to do exactly what he wanted to do. And he had the ability, like unique ability, to handle challenges, right? And that, I think, gave him a level of leadership that probably, I would say, almost everyone that I have met in the da'wah did not have, because he could handle a challenge in a very fun, capable way, where he would be able to handle that challenge without you feeling it's even challenging, okay? And one of the situations that I so vividly remember, around 2008, give or take, there was a big trial that happened in the Muslim community in Toronto. Those who know, right? And a lot of the halaqat around Toronto started to get closed down. People were extremely afraid. And I remember that same weekend, there was an Al-Maghrib course happening, and Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif heard about this. And when he heard about it, he literally very, very capably embraced that difficulty. And he said that this is a test from Allah Azza wa Jal, and Allah will help us. Allah will aid us. Allah will take care of us. Something along these lines. But I noticed that at that time, a lot of people became afraid. A lot of mashayikh, they were, you know, what should we do? Should we stop the halaqat, not answering phone calls? Why everybody's afraid? What if I get picked up in the process as well? Right? So this man, he could have had that fear as well. And I saw this literally unfolding before my eyes. I said, mashallah, like really felt like this man, you know, he's got his vision, he's going to do it. He went back to the class and he taught with the same zeal, the same passion, the same ability, the same capability. Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and didn't change any bit. He continued to do exactly what he had to do. And that was, he was going to teach. This was his goal. Nothing was going to stop him. And of course, there was many challenges that were to come, whether it be in the States and whether it be over here and other places as well. But every single time for him, the goal was establishing this institution. I'll talk to you more about the institution as well, right? So he had leadership skills, and this was one of those signs that he could embrace challenges and handle them in a way where it doesn't even look like it's a challenge for him, right? And of course, he was an introvert. There's no doubt about that. Like, he would keep to himself for the most part, but he would also try to challenge himself and meet people because he had to do that for his vision, right? And he would teach, and he himself knew his own self-worth. He would teach people to recognize your own self-worth, as Islam even teaches you to recognize your own self-worth, meaning to recognize the abilities that you have and then utilize them. And one of the incidents that I remember in this regard is that he was talking about how he was able to make Al-Maghrib, the institute he masterminded, happen. And he said, he basically talked about all of these different mashayikh that are on his roster. He said, you know, Fulan, Fulan, he gave all the names in the class. And he said, everyone had a different idea. Now, these are very accomplished human beings, like Yasser Burgess, valedictorian of his class, Yasser Qadi, the top student graduating from his master's class, you know, Muhammad Faqih, very good gentleman, and also, you know, one of the individuals who was very sought after during that time. And he took all of these people who had their own visions, and he said, I basically refocused everybody, right? And this is a level of leadership that is very difficult. Human resources is not an easy thing. The Prophet was, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, was a mastermind in human resource management as well. So in order for you to be a leader, anyone who knows anything about HR, you know how difficult that particular scope is, because you're dealing with human beings. Everybody has a different problem, right? And you have to keep everyone happy. Does anybody work in HR here? Right? You have to keep everyone happy. And so it's very complicated to do. So for him to take all of these humans who already have a vision and reorient them, refocus them, and sell to them his idea in a time where really a lot of people are against the idea. And I'll tell you why they were against the idea as well. I remember even when I would go to class, a lot of people would be like, don't go to those classes. Why? Because when you go to the class, they're like, oh, they've made a game out of the deen. Right? But wallahi, it wasn't a game. Anyways, the idea is to be able to refocus. It's a very, very unique quality. So he also recognized that he has that ability to take individuals and reorient them towards the direction that he wants to take them. This is very powerful. If you get this skill, human resource management. You know this incident in which someone came to the Prophet ﷺ and he told him about the adhan, the sahabi. And the Prophet ﷺ said that go teach it to Bilal. فَإِنَّهُ أَنْدَى مِنْكَ صَوْتًا. Go teach it to Bilal because he's more capable of giving adhan than you. This is the Prophet. Human resource management. You spotted a talent. This guy is more capable. Yes, you learned the adhan, but teach it to Bilal. He's going to be able to do a better job at that. So taking people, reorienting them, refocusing them. This was one of those abilities that he had, and that was part of his leadership. His legacy. Look, the main thing that summarizes his legacy is taking a model that existed in the Western world, and that was these weekend seminars, and basically Islamicizing them. And this is very important, because every time we see anything of modernity, we'll find some people who will be like, this needs to be rejected. When cryptocurrency came out, it cannot be halal. Why can't it be halal? Because governments haven't approved of it yet. Why? Who said for something to be halal, governments need to approve of it? This idea, by the way, let me just debunk this myth as well. Government saying something is illegal doesn't make it automatically halal. You know the whole thing about following the law of the land? Yeah, you should follow the law of the land because there's going to be legal consequences. But is it obligatory for you to? No, it isn't.
Is it obligatory from a Sharia perspective? No, it isn't. Let's say the law of the land tells you that you cannot wear a hijab. Are you going to say you have to follow the law of the land? No. If there's legal consequences, you might end up removing it because of that, like people do in France at times. But whenever you can be away from the sight of the law, what are you going to do? Put your hijab on. Right? Similarly, if they outlaw praying, salah, are you going to say follow the law of the land? No. So what we have to do is we have to take anything that modernity has to offer and Islamicize it. Anything and Islamicize it. This is a very key factor. Not everything in modernity is haram. Things that are haram, of course, we leave them. There's no doubt about it. But things that are halal, whether it be the capital markets, we can Islamicize them. There's a company called Al-Musaffa. That's what they're doing. Whether it be cryptocurrencies, there's DeFi exchanges now being made, which are halal DeFi exchanges. I work with one of them. And so the idea is that anything that modernity has to offer, you can accept it, embrace it. And that's what he did. One of those things that were really famous at that time was self-help seminars. He's going to all of them. He took the model and he took Islam and he started packaging it within this model. Okay. And really what ended up happening is that I don't even think he expected. Maybe he did, I'm not sure. But I don't know if he even expected or anticipated the level of success that this will have. Because people started coming to the seminars in large numbers. There was no other way for people to learn their deen except this. People who were university students, they didn't want to go to the masjid because again, the masjid dilemma was most of the mashayikh in the masajid, they don't know how to speak the language, they don't come prepared for the lectures. One of the reasons for that is because in the past and even till today in different masajid, there would be one sheikh doing all of the tasks. He's the one who's the janazah sheikh. He's the one who's checking the teeth of the udhiyah to make sure how many years it is. He's the one who's praying salawat. He's the one who's coming for fajr, the night prayer. He's coming for the taraweeh. He's giving the khutbah. He's preparing for the lecture. What's going to happen? Human beings cannot talk. Like, this is beyond human, right? No Muslim country does this happen. You have a sheikh, he's teaching. You have a sheikh, he's praying salawat. You have Salat al-Jumu'ah happening with another sheikh. Doesn't happen like this, right? But in the Western world, because of the lack of human resources and also financial resources, generally most masajid used to end up having one sheikh. And even till today, most masajid do that. We have over here two shuyukh. And I really pushed for that when I came here, right? The idea is that so because of this, like, people didn't want to go to these halaqat. Like, there's unprepared. And so when these more prepared seminars came, books, notebooks and exams, and everybody started flocking. Hundreds of students, thousands of students, hundreds of thousands of students. In total, they say, 120,000 students. But that's not actually the number. Because the real number is when this system was created, dozens of other institutes started following the same system, both in the Western world and also in the Eastern world now. Now they're in the East as well. There are dozens of institutions that actually opened up on the same exact model. And I've taught at some of them as well. And they have students also in the hundreds as well. I taught a class in Sri Lanka, 400 students, and they're using the exact same system. I taught another class in Pakistan, again, same type of system, and there's, again, hundreds of students learning. So when the system came in, it was embraced, other people also started embracing. So that's, I think, where the legacy lies. Now, the problem was, obviously, a lot of people, they started to criticize the sheikh. Whenever you do something new, there's going to be criticism. One of the criticisms was, you've made this into, and there's no more education, there's no ilm, it's all entertainment or edutainment. That's what you're doing. Right? And I clearly remember this allegation. And I would say, well, I mean, I didn't feel edutained. Like, I felt like I was being educated. And yes, a little bit of movement in the class here and there, that would affect us positively, right? Your cognitive abilities are only capable of comprehending enough over 8 hours, right? So this was one of the criticism. Another criticism was they're charging money. This was completely new, charging money in the Western world for Islam. Now, literally, when this happened, even in the East, when they started these institutes, they started doing the same thing. So that issue it eventually ended up being dissolved because now everybody's following the same system, charging money. In order for you to have a system that works, you need to have a financial system that also works as well. The sheikh needs to get paid. The room needs to be, you know, also hired, like whatever room you're renting out, whether it's a classroom, logistics, lodging, flights. Obviously, there's costs. So it's only natural that there's going to be a price tag attached to all of this. No, there's no billion-dollar man who's going to part ways with $10 million and say, you know, do it for the sake of Allah Azza wa Jalla. Doesn't work. This doesn't exist right now. We don't have people like that. We don't have an Uthman ibn Affan. You know, I always tell people, if he was here, we wouldn't be seeking donations, because we have people who are multimillionaires, but they don't dig deep into their pockets and give. 10,000 maybe, 5,000, 15, 20. Where is that millionaire that just comes and says, you know what, I'll build the masjid in the backdrop? Doesn't happen. So he started charging, and there was nothing wrong with that. In fact, I'll give you one example, right? So for those who want the examples from the era of the Salaf, I really picked this example out. An example is the example of a man from the 4th century in Andalusia, 319 after the Hijrah of the Prophet ﷺ. His name was Muhammad ibn Futais ibn Wasil al-Ghafiqi al-Biri, one of the ulama of that time in Andalus. And he basically went to learn the Muwatta from one of the scholars, right? And that sheikh, he demanded a payment. He wanted some dananir, right? So they paid him. After paying him, he started teaching them. He finished reading the book with them completely. He taught them. And then afterwards, Muhammad ibn Futais, he said, my heart was not content. I ended up paying someone for knowledge, right? Is this even halal? Is this okay? Is it not? So he went to a more senior sheikh in town, and he started reading a book to him. He wanted to actually ask him this question. He said, is it okay? He wanted to ask him if it's okay to charge money for knowledge, but he was afraid that this more senior sheikh, Ibn Abdul Hakam, he would think that I just came for this question, and if he's harsh, he's going to get mad at me and all that, right? So he basically played a trick. He went to the sheikh, he started reading a book to him. And after reading for a few days, he went and asked the sheikh, he said, أَصْلَحَكَ اللَّهُ, which is one of the ways that historically they would use to begin a question. He said, أَصْلَحَكَ اللَّهُ الْعَالِمُ يَأْخُذُ الْعُجْرَةَ عَلَىٰ قِرَاءَةِ الْعِلْمِ. Can a scholar take money for teaching ilm? And immediately the scholar, he realized what's happening. He knows he went to that guy and he was charging and he learned a book and now he's coming to verify with me. So he said that he hid his book out of anger because he realized you're basically trying to contest what that sheikh did with you. And after he calmed down a little bit and he said, this is allowed. Afakallah, may Allah forgive you, or may Allah fix you. And then he said, this is completely okay. He said, I can read one page for one dirham, one silver coin if I so wanted. Right? No problem. This is again one of the scholars of the Salaf, and I have dozens of examples like this. I actually started looking into this because again, there's always this accusation leveled. What are you doing? Charging for knowledge? A'udhu billah. Right? The charge is not for knowledge, but exactly what this scholar said. He said that, who has forced me, listen to this, who has forced me to sit with you for the whole day? Who has forced me to sit with you for the whole day and leave my family and not earn wealth for them and look after them? I'm spending my time here and I have a family to look after. Of course I do it. So he was charging, yes. But he didn't take all of the profits for himself. This is something that a lot of people don't know, right? He left all of the gains for the sake of Allah Azza wa Jalla. All of them. Like, yes, he would, just as all the other instructors and all these weekend courses, they get a small fee, maybe $1,000 or $2,000 or something like that, whatever is reasonable and whatever place it is. But beyond that, all of the profits are for Allah. There's no other thing, and there's nothing wrong with this. And literally the Prophet said, as I said, The problem is sometimes we like to become more religious than the Prophet ﷺ. Literally. There is examples of Ibn Abbas paying for knowledge in Bukhari. There is the Prophet ﷺ literally saying that the best thing that you can take money for is the book of Allah Azza wa Jalla. This is also in Bukhari. So what else is left? You want to become more righteous than the Prophet ﷺ himself? And accuse people of this and that and the other? And the least we can say is, the most simple thing we can say, is literally what Imam An-Nawawi said. He said that, after he quoted the hadith that I just quoted, he said, this is a clear sign that it is permissible to take money for ruqya, reading fatiha, doing dhikr for people. All of that is halal and this is not makruh. And just like that is teaching Quran. And this is the madhab of Imam al-Shafi'i, Malik, Ahmed, Ishaq, Abu Thawr. Because this is the hadith of Rasulullah. What more do you want? So this accusation obviously is meaningless in reality. And there's no meaning to it, but I'm explaining this because this was one of the things that was leveled. It was a completely new idea. We have a weekend seminar. We're going to charge some fee for it. And then obviously, even the people who were criticized eventually embraced the same idea because they realized the model is working. You can't beat them, join them, right? So the other thing that really I think he did very well, and I remember he would plant this in the minds of students all the time. He changed the perception of money in the minds of students, okay? And I think that I actually got affected by that as well. That every now and then he would challenge the status quo. Is it like, is money a problem? Is it a sin? Wait, Abu Bakr is a rich man. Fulan was a rich man. This was a rich man. I always say these things in my classes as well, right? But this was one of the status quos he challenged. One of the things he has a course called, I've never taken it, but something like Millionaire Who Went to Jannah. You could look into it. I don't know what's inside of it. But that's another thing that he would talk about, right? One time he said something, and I remember it registered in my mind, and I thought about it for many years afterwards. He said, what if a sheikh comes to the masjid and he has a Ferrari? Right? You remember that. Everybody remembers that, right? So, what if a sheikh comes to the masjid and he has a Ferrari? Remember, he left millions of dollars for the sake of Allah Azza wa Jalla. I'm not trying to paint him as a money-hungry human being. He left literally as waqf millions of dollars. Because Al-Maghrib probably went on to become, one would estimate, I don't know their books, but at least a multi-million dollar institute, right? So, he said, what if a sheikh comes to the masjid with a Ferrari? What would you say? He's questioning the status quo. Why can't a sheikh come to the masjid with a Ferrari? Ask yourself, why not? What's the problem with that? Why? Really? What's the problem with that? You might say, oh, but he's telling us to give sadaqah. Maybe he's a billionaire. Maybe he's a, you know, like if a billionaire, to him, it's not even a 0.5% of his wealth, right? And I remember going to King Saud University. One day I went to the parking lot as I'm coming out of my class. One of my mashayikh, he drove in with a Porsche Cayenne. That is $170,000-$180,000 car, right? And I immediately remembered what Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif said. I thought to myself, like, subhanAllah. And this was not like your average sheikh. This was like one of the top professors we had in our school. He was very intelligent, very smart. You could tell he's close to Allah. His ilm was right on. Like, he was one of the people I really looked up to. And I was talking in the parking lot, a Porsche Cayenne. Right? What's the problem with that? There's no problem with that. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he said in a hadith that, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُحِبُّ أَن يُرَى أَثَرَ نِعْمَتِهِ عَلَى عَبْدِهِ. Allah loves to see the athar, the example of the ni'mah, or the sign of the ni'mah of Allah Azza wa Jal upon his slave. No problem. Right? For a person who has $1 million, goes buy a Lamborghini, that will be israf. Half of his wealth, he spent it on a car. Someone who has $100 million, he buys a $500,000 car. Is that israf? Is that exaggerating? It's not even 0.5% of his wealth, right? So, there's no, like, he can still give millions of dollars, but this is a little bit of his wealth, no problem. And sometimes people do that for other reasons. You won't understand until, like, you understand. I have friends who are multimillionaires. They live a very simple lifestyle, but they have a nice car. Why? Some of them, they say it allows me into different situations where I can increase my business, right? When people see you have a nice car, sometimes they let you into greater business opportunities. So there's, again, there's no problem with that. So all of those notions, they ended up, you know, completely disappearing. And the haters, they disappeared. And the system that he created, it took the whole Western world literally by a storm, and then literally the rest of the world as well. I used to live in Malaysia. Al-Maghrib was one of the biggest institutes in Malaysia, and there were probably a dozen, two dozen, maybe three dozen, more than that, institutions, all of whom were following the same model at this point. All of whom. I taught at multiple institutions in Malaysia, teaching in the same model. Al-Kawthar, I taught there for a couple of years, exact same model. It was literally copied, you know, hook, line, and sinker from the Al-Maghrib model, right? So this went around the world, and people benefited from it immensely. And I think one of the things that we really need to stop at is his ability to found. Now, not everybody is a founder. You know what I mean by a founder? Like taking a concept and creating a product and then creating systems to be able to maintain the sale of that product. This is what founders do. They have a vision for the future and they end up developing that vision. Today, we have the ability to have any knowledge, literally, at our fingertips. Information technology has reached to that point where, you know, during the time of Sheikh Muhammad, it wasn't there, but still, it was better than before, right? But now, literally anything you want, minutes you can get it. You want it packaged in audio, you want it in video, you want it in reading, you want someone to read you a book, all of that is there, right? Podcasts, whatever you want, you can do it. It's so simplified to a degree that never in human history has information been so simplified. So you can get information about everything. What founders do is they take this information and they create a vision for the future through it. They make a solution, they make a product, and then they develop a foundation and a system to be able to market and sell and bring to the world this product. So that's exactly what he did. He had a system in place. He made a course, which was a product, and he courses products, and he made a system around it, and that system really flourished, right? And if any of you are interested in this, and I tell you all to be interested in this, really, read a book by the name of Zero to One. Zero to One. It's a very beautiful book, and it's written by a man by the name of Peter Thiel. He's one of the founders of PayPal, and he also founded a number of other companies. Currently, if you know anything about what's going on now, one of the big companies that everybody wants to get into is, at least investment, is Palantir. He's also a founder of Palantir as well. But he very nicely sums up how to found, how to take an idea for a simple concept and make it into a startup and be able to found. And there is a process. Once you master it, you can found. So he mastered this process. He founded the foundation of an institution. And many of the institutions, they were not founded in the systems were imperfect. So they kind of lived, but then they died as well. They kind of lived and they died as well. Now, I'm not saying that they have a perfect system in that institution right now. That's not my intention. But I'm saying that at least he was able to make a system that works. And it went around the world. It was replicated by hundreds of thousands of people. And that is ingenious. That quality of being able to found is not something that everybody can do. It requires a level of focus that you will only find out when you try to found, right? I have worked with multiple startups in the capacity of advisory. So I know them going from literally zero to $1 billion. And so I have seen this happening and the level of focus that it requires for a person to really invest himself completely in a startup and bring it to fruition. It's very difficult. It's not a task and a feat that everybody can handle, right? So this was one of the things that I think we can take from here. Read that book, Peter Thiel, as I said, Zero to One. And there's other books on this topic as well, but this is a very simple guide of a successful founder, right? And the other thing is that Allah gave this man qabul. He gave him acceptance, right? You could tell whenever you hear him, there's a level of ikhlas in what he's saying, sincerity, and he would touch people in that way. And it suffices to say that everybody is mentioning him with goodness. Everybody, right? Even the people who are his critics, they actually caved in and they started saying good things about him as well. This is qabul from Allah, acceptance from Allah Azza wa Jal. And We all make the dua that Ibrahim alayhi salam used to make, and he would say, Rabbi habli min as-salihin, and he would say that, he would say, waj'al li lisana sidqin fil akhirin, oh Allah, make a positive mention for me after I die for generations. So we ask Allah to make a positive mention for us after we die for generations. And here I want to say something about critics. You know, some of the criticism that I've already told you about, right? This was something that I would very, very regularly hear when I was a student in Saudi Arabia. Students of knowledge, one of their biggest pitfalls is they just love to backbite. Wallahi. And they love to contest and they think they know it all. And so I would hear all of these young students of knowledge who haven't even sometimes finished reading Arabic and learning Arabic. One of the main people that was the subject of their backbiting during that time because he was doing something was Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif. He's doing this and he's making people, you know, taking them away from the deen. He's making classes that are intermingling and he's doing this and he's doing that. Look today. People are going to the janazah of this man from across the world. This is a sign of acceptance from Allah. People are speaking good of him. People who are much senior than him, they're saying, this was our mentor. This was our leader. Sheikh Yasir Birjas, who's older than him in age as well, he's literally saying, this was our leader. Why? Because he had leadership skills, it was clear. Sheikh Yasir Qadi literally said something similar to the same effect. He said that, this was my mentor. Why? Because like this is a man of genuine ikhlas, a man who really had something to offer to the ummah. And literally, I'll say to you the same thing that Imam Ahmad said to his son. He said that between us and the people of innovation, because that's what they would like to call it, person of innovation, is the day that we have our janazah. People always talk about tablighi jamaat and all these things. Look at the sheikh who died over here from Masjid Quba. He was a tablighi man. Did you see his janazah? We have never witnessed a janazah like this over here in this city. Innovator? Wallahi alladhi la ilaha illahu. No. No. This is a man of ikhlas, of sincerity. This is a man of sincerity as well. People are not, like Allah's Prophet said in a hadith, antum shuhada'ullahi fil ard. You are the witnesses of Allah within this land, right? And another thing that I want to say, and I really am convinced on this particular point, is that I personally believe that Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif was among the revivers of the 15th century. And I say this with a lot of conviction. I've read a lot into biographies. I like to believe that biographical accounts is one of my specialities. I've read thousands of biographies, without exaggeration. And I know how people are and the things that they achieve, right? I sincerely, honestly believe this man was among the revivers. And what do I mean by that? The hadith in Abu Dawood, the Prophet ﷺ, he said that Allah sends upon the beginning of every 100 years, someone who revives the religion for the people, right? And that revival happens in different ways. It happens in systems. This was the case with Sheikh Muhammad. It happens in on the fortes of development. It happens on the forte of ilm itself, knowledge. It happens in many different scopes, right? And it can be many different individuals as well. As Ibn Rislan in his book, in his explanation of Sunan Abi Dawood, he said that this doesn't have to be one person. It could be many, many people, right? It's not one revivalist. It could be multiple people doing different aspects of the task, and also multiple people in different regions as well. So within the Western Hemisphere, Sheikh Muhammad created a system that really circumvented everything around them. Everyone that knows that working within masjid systems is very difficult, because the boards, most of them are made up of people who don't actually know much about Islam. They're trying to bring the corporate experiences to the masjid. They don't know how to handle it. They put misplaced people. Human resources are not managed properly. So he had to circumvent this whole system and create a system that would be able to bring knowledge to people. And it did, in a way that would help bring people to Islam. And it did exactly that. So in this way, I really truly believe that this man was among the revivers of the 15th century. And why do I say that? Because he was born in 1395. 6 years later, he would have started to memorize the Quran. right? So literally at the beginning of the century, this is the time where he's really getting started. And when they say, عَلَى رَأْسِ كُلِّ مِئَةِ سَنَةٍ, Abdul Haqq al-Dihlawi explained that this means towards the end of the century or the beginning of the century. So he came literally around towards the end of the century and the beginning of the century. So he created a system that was definitely revolutionary. There's not a single person who's involved in Islamic education within the Western world. No one. One of the biggest institutions now is the institution of Nu'man Ali Khan. He wrote on his Facebook page, he said, this man is a pioneer in Islamic education, because anyone that knows that the system that he created was pioneering. Nobody else had thought about bringing this Western system into the Islamic space and making a product out of it and bringing it to the people. So this is really a system that was pioneering. And in that way, I believe he's one of the mujaddideen, one of the revolutionaries, one of the revivalists of Islam within the modern era, within the 15th Hijri century. And of course, he died very, very young, but I think he lived past most of the people's ages, because in a short period of time, he was able to accomplish this. And one of the things, like, I always used to wonder, I wanted to actually go to Dubai and ask him, like, what's going on, right? He finished what he had to do and retired. Basically, I mean, he started something else called Discover You. You can go check it out. But it wasn't completely in tune with what he had studied. It was trying to incorporate, you know, self-help and Islamic knowledge and all these different things. And he was enjoying his life. But basically, he accomplished what he had to do. As the Prophet said, اِعْمَلُوا فَكُلُّ مُيَسَّرٌ لِمَا خُلِقَ لَهُ. Do, and everyone is going to be paved through for whatever they've been created. He did what he had to do and he retired, right? So this is always a mystery. Why did he just like leave, you know? But maybe he was trying to develop himself, read Quran. I don't know. I didn't have too close of a personal relationship with him, even though we met multiple times after the Islamic events he would do. And I knew him and he knew me as well, but we didn't weren't friends or something like that. But we knew each other and he knew I was one of his students. And the last time I met him and he saw me, he was very, very happy actually. Because I was just graduating from King Saud University, 2013 June, and right after my graduation, literally, yes, I graduated the next weekend, I flew out to Dubai. And when I went there, randomly, I wasn't even expecting to meet Sheikh Muhammad there. I didn't even know he lived there, to be honest. And I was just going for lunch and I saw Sheikh Muhammad at Nando's. And Sheikh Muhammad, he saw me, he told me to come sit down, have lunch with me. I had lunch with him, so he started catching up. He said, when are you finishing your education? He knew I was studying at King Saud at that time. He said, when are you finishing your education? He started asking me, what have you been up to? And he actually tried to reorient me as well, by the way. Just as a, like he tried to change what I wanted to do to whatever he thought I should be doing. And he said to me, what are you going to do next? So I said, I want to continue my education. I want to do a master's or a PhD. And he said that, you don't need a master's, you don't need a PhD. Khalas, you've learned enough ilm. Now you need to go back and teach the people. And I said, wallahi, I am still teaching the people. You know that, Sheikh. But I still want to continue my education. He really tried hard. He said, when I graduated, I went to University of Chicago. And he really, really tried hard on this point, but he wasn't able to convince me. I really wanted to continue my education and I did, alhamdulillah. But one of the things I saw that day was that he was sitting there very beautifully. Like the man was so jolly. Every time you attest to that, like every time you meet him, he puts a smile on your face because he's so jolly and happy. You know that he's happy in life, right? So he was peeling meat off of drumsticks at the Nando's. Like he was peeling it off. It was a very difficult feat to use fork and knife to peel it off. I was peeling it off and he was slowly but surely bringing all of that meat into his daughter's plates, right? And to see that, I was just so amazed and like you could see the love in what he's doing, right? And when I got home, I have little daughters as well. At that time, they were even more younger. I did exactly the same. I wanted to mimic this practice of bringing food to my children. And I got affected even by what he was doing. Another thing is the Sheikh used to recite very beautifully, very melodious. Go online, type in recitation of Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif. So one day I asked the Sheikh, I said, why don't you record the Quran? Really, I think his recitation especially in his prime when his lungs were good and all that, right? Because as you're younger, you have more energy to recite in your 20s, early 30s. As you get older, it becomes weaker. So I told him, why don't you record the Quran? Right? And I came to know someone else, maybe many people told him this, right? So he said that, he looked at me and said, you know, that's a big responsibility. He's a hafiz of the Quran. He's worried because once you make a mistake, what happens? It gets recorded, and it's if it's a tajweed mistake, he has mastery of tajweed. He had ijazah in tajweed, right? One thing that I'll leave you off with. The ijazah in tajweed reminded me of this. I remember this answer of his that it really got engraved in my mind. We were leaving to dinner as usual after al-Maghrib classes. And I was sitting right next to him, the Sheikh. And I said, Sheikh, I wanted you to tell me, like, what did you learn? Like, I was really into deep learning, and I still am to some degree. So I said, what did you learn when you were in Saudi Arabia? I know you have a bachelor's degree and all that, but I want to know, like, which mashayikh you studied with, who did you read to, and these type of questions. I started asking him. He gave me a couple of things. He told me I read Tuhfa Siniya, Sharh al-Ajrumiya to XYZ. And he said he had memorized the Quran when he was younger, but he recited the Quran to one of the shuyukh and he got his Hafs and Hasim ijazah. And he said that, and then he said a couple of other things, but not much else. Now, really, as a person who had studied there, I know that really that is something, but it's not a lot outside of extracurricular, that is. And then he said something else. He said, but a lot of people in the world, they collect knowledge all of their lives, but they don't do anything with it. They don't do anything with it. And I decided to do something with the knowledge that I did collect. And that's exactly what we see. He was not even within the Al-Maghrib Institute. He wasn't one of the top instructors in terms of knowledge. He wasn't an allama. He was very humble. He would say, I don't know, very regularly. This was one of the things that was very easy to him. Even though he's the head of the institute, every time you ask him a question, he doesn't say, Wallahu a'lam. Wallahu a'lam. Very easy for him to say that. He knew his place. He would say, Wallahu a'lam. But what he did is he took the knowledge he had and he did something with this knowledge. And I really did not understand the depth of this particular comment of his until I went through the system and I saw my own peers. Now I've graduated almost 10 years ago from King Saud University. And I saw my own peers at that time, what they did and what they didn't do, right? Some of them, they got involved in work. Some of them, they left to other things. Some of them, they've forgotten all of their knowledge. Some of them, all sorts of things. People who are very strong students of knowledge, they didn't do anything with the knowledge. So it's not about how much you collect. It's not about that. It's about what you do with it in your life, what you do with it in terms of teaching it to people, things that you create out of this knowledge that Allah has granted you. It doesn't always have to be teaching people because knowledge teaches you to create. Maybe you learn about awqaf, for example, endowments. Make a fund for endowment. There's one of the mashayikh, he recently came back. This is his goal in life. He wants to make an endowment for Islam, for Islamic studies within the Western world. This is his goal. He gained a lot of knowledge. He saw something practical within it. He wanted to implement. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to have mercy on our dear Shaykh Muhammad al-Sharif. And I say, Allahumma ghafir li hayyina wa mayyitina wa shahidina wa ghaibina wa saghirina wa kabirina wa dhakarina wa unthana. Allahumma man ahyaytahu minna fa ahyihi ala al-Islam wa man tawaffaytahu minna fa tawaffahu ala al-Iman. Allahumma la tahrimna ajrahu wa la tudillana ba'dah. وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين.